This is Probabilities. I'm Richard Walensky with my co-host Richard A. Loopoff. Our guest is Richard Matheson, author of a number of novels, including I Am Legend, The Shrinking Man, Bid Time Return, What Dreams May Come, Hell House, also author of numerous short stories, screenplays, including The Incredible Shrinking Man, House of Usher, Pit in the Pendulum, The Last Man on Earth, Die, Die, My Darling, Somewhere in Time, and author of numerous teleplays for Twilight Zone and other TV shows. What brought you to writing? You wrote for pulp magazines or the digest magazines in your early career, writing science fiction. What brought you to write that?
Well, I was writing all my life. I lived in Brooklyn, and I had little stories and poems in the Brooklyn Eagle when I was 8, 9 years old. When I was 16, I wrote a novel. I wrote short stories all through my teen years. I never tried to do anything with it, though, until I got out of college. That was when I had my first sale. I was always a buff of fantasy. I read fantasy all my life, and I thought it was a fantasy story. It turned out, according to them, to be a science fiction story. Since there were about 30 or 40 science fiction magazines, and my mother raised a practical kid, I decided I would become a science fiction writer and boned up on all the anthologies I could find and started writing it, even though I never really had any feeling for it, and I haven't really done that much, as far as I can tell. The first story I saw was called Born of Man and Woman, and it created enough of a splash so that I was able to get an agent and go on from there. The novel was called The Years Stood Still. I was raised as a Christian Scientist, and there was a story in the textbook, Science and Health, about some woman in her teen years who had fallen down a flight of steps and never aged, and so that when she was in her 50s and 60s, she still looked like she was almost a teenager. So that was what I wrote the novel about. It was very lurid, very melodramatic, and I don't think I could rework it and sell it.
Your two first novels that were published were Someone is Bleeding and Fury on Sunday by Lion Books. It's paperback publisher published Jim Thompson as well. How did they come to be published?
Well, I guess that's where my agent submitted them to, and there was quite a market in original paperbacks in those days. Someone is Bleeding. The first chapter is almost a direct account of how I met my wife on the beach in Santa Monica, and then it goes on to a much more melodramatic story. The second one is a very short period suspense piece, which I wrote in 3 days, the novel, that is. I think they paid $1,000 for each one, so that when I sold I Am Legend to Gold Medal for $3,000, I thought I was really in the chips.
Now, I Am Legend, that came out in 1954. Did you have any idea at that point that it would be made not into one movie, but into two? Would that have boggled your mind at the time?
I don't think it's been made into one movie yet. The first one was a very poor adaptation of it. The second one was so far removed from it that if you hadn't seen the title on the screen, you would not have had any idea it came from my book. It is yet to be made, and I've been approached many times through the years by people who want to make it, but it's so wrapped up in various kinds of litigations now that I doubt if it'll ever be done. I wrote the original screenplay for I Am Legend. I did it in England for Hammer Films, and then they told me at the time the censor wouldn't pass it. I thought they were just being, like, euphemistic because they didn't like the script, but later on I found out that was literally true. The censor wouldn't pass it, and then Robert Lippert took it over here, and at one point told me it was going to be directed by Fritz Lang, which turned out not to be the case. It was directed by Sidney Salco.
And the second version, The Omega Man, with Charlton Heston, did you have anything whatsoever to do with that?
No, none whatever. Nothing.
The novel you did after that was Shrinking Man, which became The Incredible Shrinking Man, the movie which you did work on. What do you think of that movie?
Yeah, the novel, I wanted to call the novel Shrinking Man without the V in it. I wanted to make social commentary and refer to mankind's shrinking capacity to deal with his world and victimization by it. But not only was the book The Shrinking Man, but then the movie, the producer decided to add incredible to the title as if it weren't incredible enough that a man is shrinking. I like it more now. At the time, I wasn't crazy about it, but it's always been my reaction or my failure or whatever. Usually, I always dislike, very rarely do I like a film made from what I've written the first time around. It's very rare. But then over time, I mellow out, and I like it better. So I recognize it for what it is, a very unusual film for that period of time.
What did you feel the movie lacked at the time?
I wanted to have the continuity be as it was in the book, going back and forth in time. I would have liked to see a lot more intense study of the man's relationship with his wife as he got smaller and smaller. Because they did it in a straight continuity and they wanted to get to the good stuff, they just sort of almost glossed over it. They didn't go into it that much. Once they got in the cellar with the really big effect, then it was great.
We interviewed Jack Arnold a few years back, who was the director, and he told a story about using condoms for the water drops.
The famous condom story, yes.
Were you there for any of the filming?
Yeah, I watched him shoot some of the scenes in the cellar. The poor guy who played the lead, he was almost electrocuted, he was almost drowned, he had bruises, really. And of course, I don't think he used a stuntman ever, and he was really banged around a lot.
Arnold told us also that at the completion of that project, you and he had got along very well and had together talked about doing a sequel, The Shrinking Woman, which you had actually got as far as at least a written sketch. Is this true?
Yeah, I don't recall that it had anything to do with our relationship, but just the producer, Albert Zucksmith, since the picture had made so much money, wanted to do a sequel, and I wrote a script. I wrote a full shooting script, which was never shot.
Did you have anything to do with the film eventually that was made, a Lily Tomlin film, The Shrinking Woman, or The Incredible Shrinking Woman?
No, I'm glad to say I didn't. They spoke to me about writing a sequel, and I, in my naivete, thought that they were going to go back and do the book. And I again said to them, as I said to you before, well, I'd like to do it in the way it's written, jumping back and forth in time and really get into the characterization. Little did I know they were going to turn it into a comedy, which is okay. I mean, I think I could have written a better comedy than that. It really wasn't that funny.
Richard Matheson, you wrote three other novels before it looks like you just went right into writing films for Roger Corman. Is that pretty much what happened?
I got so involved in doing television and motion pictures, and also we were raising four children, so the money was a lot better, so that's why I concentrated on that.
You moved into television. How did that come about?
Well, for years I had an agent out here. I don't remember who they were, but they never called, and I didn't know agents were supposed to call. And then we joined an agency called Preminger Stewart, which had Otto Preminger's brother and Malcolm Stewart. And all of a sudden, we got all these calls. And this was Charles Beaumont and myself. We both joined at the same time. And all of a sudden, we were going out and talking to people, which we had never done before. And one of the first places we went, if not the first, was to see the pilot of The Twilight Zone. And then we started submitting and became a part of that.
Do you have much contact with Rod Serling?
We would see him. Once in a while, we would socialize. But, of course, we always saw him when we had discussions of the stories and the scripts. He and the producer, Buck Houghton, Charles Beaumont and I wrote separately then, although we did collaborate when we first went into television. We collaborated on quite a few different shows.
Did Serling have as much of an impact on the actual shows as today we think he did?
Well, he wrote, I would say conservatively, about 80% of them, so obviously he had to have an enormous impact on the texture of the show. Being a writer, he was very supportive of writers, so I don't recall ever having had an outrageous demand made regarding the script. The satisfaction I ever had in The Twilight Zone was maybe some of the casting or something like how it was done.
The most famous one that you wrote was also remade in the movie, which was Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. Mm-hmm. Do you recall how you got the idea for that one?
Yeah, I was on an airplane, and I was looking out, and the clouds were all fluffy, and I thought, gee, it would be interesting if you saw a guy come skiing out of the sky, just like it was snow. And then I thought about it some more, and I thought, gee, what if you looked out in the wing and there was a man out there? You know, and then from there, I naturally went into the Gremlin idea and built up a suspense. It was a novelette first.
Did you work on the revised version as well?
Yeah, I wrote the revised version as well. Originally, it was going to be like a, at least they told me it was going to be a 10 or 12 minute filler, and I never could understand how they could do that. And then they told me Gregory Peck was going to be in it, so I was rewriting it to fit the character he had in 12 O'Clock High, the same man who goes on an airplane. And then that fell through, and then George, well, the Australian director, Miller, took over, and he decided to just go back to square one. I mean, square a half, actually, because he chose not to have the man being recovering from a mental breakdown, which I think is what adds the extra element to it. He just had the guy who was scared of flying, and Lithgow did a marvelous job of, you know, starting out at 100% of terror and then going on up from there. I don't know how he did it.
It was considered the best part of the movie, too.
And actually, the way it was done was, of course, superior, although I think I would match Bill Shatner's performance against that anytime. I did like the monster on the wing a hell of a lot better, because the monster in the early one, because they were on a budget, sort of looked like a woolly bear.
Would you comment on the fact that those early, the first series Twilight Zone, the black and white, were obviously, if we look at them today, done for about 35 cents a piece, and yet they're immensely effective, even though they're 30 years old?
People always ask me why, and I say they're because they're interesting stories. Somebody was just quoted as saying story is the whole thing, and that's what I've been good at, telling an interesting story, and I think those are their best Twilight Zones are just very interesting stories that you wonder what happens next, which of course is the essential need in any kind of presentation like that.
That brings up the role of Serling that I mentioned before. If he was a writer and he gave both himself and other writers that kind of support, so the writers' concepts were the ones that were translated, you're talking about a very different world than producers and high concepts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had, I don't know, maybe they do it now on certain series, but back then I think it was very unusual. We would have a three-day rehearsal before they shot. And with, you know, with the director, with the cast, we'd walk through the, and the writer was there, which, again, was extremely unusual. I've never had that experience, again, except for on my movie Somewhere in Time. That's the only time I was ever asked to be on a film. And it made a difference, because as things needed to be adjusted, the writer was there to make the adjustment. And you got a continuity, a synchronicity of attitude towards it during this rehearsal period.
Many of those early Twilight Zone stories, other than the original stories by Serling himself, were based on existing science fiction or fantasy short stories, including many Richard Matheson stories, such as Third from the Sun. Is there a natural congruence between those old short stories and the 30-minute TV form?
No, not necessarily. I didn't use too many of my stories in the beginning. Charles Beaumont used a lot of his. I don't know why. I preferred doing originals. I think it's better to do originals. I don't think converting anything to film works as well as doing an original designed directly for it. They buy huge novels and then they say, well, we'll just use this one section of it. And, you know, it's not the novel anymore. The closest proper length for a film, a feature film, would probably be a long novelette. And it depends, again, on whether the writer is a visual writer or not. Now, I happen to be a very visual writer. When I write a short story, I see it in my mind, so it's the same thing as if I'm writing a script. That's why a lot of my stories transfer easily to the visual form. But some writers don't do that, and then it would be more difficult.
You also wrote for a number of other TV shows, including Have Gun Will Travel and Hitchcock. Did you ever have any contact with Hitchcock?
The only contact I had with Hitchcock was when it looked like I had a chance to write the screenplay for The Birds. I thought I was going to meet with his representative and my representative. Neither of them showed up. So it was just me alone with Hitchcock, and I screwed myself out of a job with my opening remark, which was, I don't think you should show The Birds too much, Mr. Hitchcock. He said, oh, no, no, no. And that was the end of that. And yet, to this day, I think I'm right, because I think the most effective scene in the movie is when they're in the house and the birds are outside, and you don't see them. You hear the sound. You see the beaks pecking through the door. She's up in that room, and she's got a blanket over her. They're spectacular, the bird scenes, but I don't think they're as... They certainly don't capture the Daphne du Maurier story. And, of course, I was naively thinking that he was going to adapt the Daphne du Maurier story.
You wrote for many other TV series, one of which intrigues me. I found it in your credits, but I have no recollection of ever seeing it. Philip Marlowe.
That was one of the things I did with Charles Beaumont. He and I guess, collaborated in about five or six different series. That was one of them. I don't even remember the story.
Are there any stories or episodes of any particular series other than Twilight Zone that really stick out in your mind as among your best work?
Well, I was very happy at the time. Actually, I was happier at the time with the work I did on a script called Lawman, which was a Western series. I liked it. The producer, Jules Shermer, had been a film producer at 20th Century Fox, approached it in a very intelligent way. There was a drawback because the lead actor was a little stiff. But they did it very well, and he had a director, one of his main directors had worked with this fellow who made the film in the South Seas. I was extremely happy with him. He was one of the few, like the Twilight Zone, he saw to it that they shot my scripts word for word. He never allowed them. Once he was happy with the script, he never allowed them to change a word.
Two made-for-TV movies from 1971. One was Duel. That was the one that was put Steven Spielberg on the map. The other was The Night Stalker, which was considered one of the best made-for-television movies of all time.
Well, Duel, it was a novelette. I had tried for years to interest serious television producers in that idea, and they would always say, no, that's not enough for a story there. And so I finally gave up on it, wrote a novelette, which was in Playboy. Then they got interested in it. And even then I thought, well, you can't just make a whole film out of a guy, even though there were only hour and a half films those days. You can't just have a film about a man being chased by a guy in a truck. Maybe you'd have to add the man's wife. And fortunately, the man who produced it and the executive at Universal knew better. So I did it pretty much as the story was written. And then they couldn't cast it. They couldn't find, again, there was Gregory Peck's name came up. You know, he's the one actor who I've his name has come up many times, but I've never had him in anything I wrote. And they had to shut down their series, McLeod, in order to get Dennis Weaver. They couldn't get a director. I remember the producer, George Eckstein, saying, well, I've cast a truck so far. That's all I've got. Then he said, I remember him saying, well, they stuck me with some young hotshot director here. You don't know. And then Stephen was out in the desert shooting this thing, and I guess I was told that by the time they saw the footage, they couldn't take him off it, although they were kind of horrified by what was going on. That's what I was told, anyway. All the disparate pieces, they couldn't see how it was going to fit together. And it fit together very well.
What about Night Stalker?
A guy named Jeff Rice had written an unpublished novel, and ABC liked it, and so they called me in, and I met Dan Curtis and did the script for it. The main alteration I made, a lot of the incidents were in the book, so it's a very interesting novel, which was published consequently. In the book, he's sort of a heavy Hungarian who believes in vampires, and I didn't think that would work, so I turned it into a more of a front-page atmosphere, with the conflict between the editor and the wisecracking reporter, who, of course, doesn't believe it at all and has to be convinced. And I didn't know it was going to turn out so good. I mean, there was a story which they had published about when my wife and my kids and I were on a camping trip, and we stopped in Las Vegas to watch it. And I saw the script, and it was like a Technicolor dream, that, you know, all the colored pages, which to me meant rewriting. And I thought, oh, my God, they've changed everything. There's not a damn thing left. And so I got so upset and enraged that I left, which apparently ticked Darren McGavin off at the time. Later we made peace. But then when I saw it on television, they had added a scene here and there, but it was still pretty much what I had written. Beautifully done. Dan is wonderful at casting. He has always been great at casting, and it was cast with a lot of marvelous performers.
We're talking on Probabilities on KPFA with author Richard Matheson. A number of your early works in the 50s and 60s deal, and I'm thinking specifically Duel, I Am Legend, Incredible Shrinking Man, they deal with technology run amok, and they're cautionary tales. I take it this was very deliberate on your part.
Well, I Am Legend is more like a disease, a plague. It's not technology run amok. The Shrinking Man is the, you know, everybody was doing the oh, I've got caught, the atom bomb has caused giant grasshoppers or something. So this was my version of, the atom bomb has done something, kind of nasty here. I combined it with something else to cause the effect. It was just an excuse. I discussed it with some scientists, and they grudgingly allowed us, well, it's possible, but it was just an excuse for the story.
I read Hell House last week, and immediately thereafter watched the movie on video. What are your comments there?
Well, that was another one where I was extremely disappointed. Later on, you sort of forget the connection between the book and the movie, and you just sort of try to look at the movie, or you come to look at the movie as its own entity. And with that in mind, it's not that bad. But if you look at it as a direct representation of the book, then that's when you get disappointed. And around just after this film was made, The Exorcist came out, and the horror film became like an A product rather than a B product. And I think that if I had held on to it, if I'd known I'd have held on to it, I think it could have been a much more prestigious type of film. At the time, my dream cast was Elizabeth Taylor and her husband Richard Burton to play the female psychic and the male psychic, and Rod Steiger and his wife to play the parapsychologist and his wife, and then a really top-class director and top-class effects, and I think it would have, and also they sort of just hinted at the sexuality of the book, which is rather extreme, and they at that time couldn't do it, but shortly afterward, anything was allowed.
Going back a little bit earlier in your movie-making career, movie-writing career, you worked for Corman on the Poe films, and how did that come about?
I didn't realize that he had an agreement that he was producer and director, but I, except for some comments on the rewriting, I met almost entirely with Nicholson and Arkoff, who were the heads of American International, and mostly with Nicholson. He was my voice in court. He and I became friends, and he was a very, very nice man, and he was always on my side. Arkoff is a nice man, but he's much more of a tough businessman. He was out to make the buck rather than to make the first-class film, although I was told later on that when he went to New York, he would take a taxi right from the airport to the Broadway area, have a fast hot dog, and start going to plays, which is something I don't think Nicholson ever did. So there's a little odd contrast there.
When we interviewed George Baxt, he was telling wild and crazy stories about the making of Burn, Witch, Burn. Did you have any contact with Baxt, or did he come on the rewrite after you were there?
I honestly don't know what it is he did on that film. I know he's always talking about it, but I see the film, and I remember what Chuck Beaumont and I wrote, and I don't see that it's that different.
You've mentioned Beaumont any number of times. We were chatting before we went on the air about fantasy science fiction writers of a certain era, and it seems that there was a group, Beaumont and yourself, Richard Matheson, Theodore Sturgeon, and Ray Bradbury, not only had a certain similarity of attitude and technique, but also your careers are constantly intertwining. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, well, there were others of us, too, in the group. There was George Clayton Johnson, who also wrote for The Twilight Zone. There was Ray Russell, who was an editor for Playboy, who bought some of my early stories, and then finally just became a writer on his own. Ray Bradbury, of course, was the grand meister of all of us. He was our inspiration, and we all imitated him, outrageously in the beginning before we got our own voice. We saw each other. We socialized. And Ted Sturgeon was also considerably older than I was. I remember when I first met him, he was working for Time magazine or something, and I had just sold my first story, Born of Man and Woman. And he didn't have a beard. He was not the sort of the colorful character he became later on. I have always felt that at his best, nobody wrote fantasy or science fiction better than Ted Sturgeon did. He did some brilliant, absolutely brilliant stuff. There was a very close contact between Charles Beaumont and myself because our children are somewhat of the same age. We socialized with them. Our wives knew each other. We visited each other and saw each other a good deal and were influential on each other. Like when he wrote his first straight novel, The Intruder, I wrote my first straight novel, The Beardless Warriors. And we always had this sort of friendly competition going on between us.
And then later on, whether this is irony or what, you wrote the screenplay for The Martian Chronicles by Bradbury.
Yeah. It just worked out that way. He initially had asked me, did I want to adapt some of the Hour things on it? I said, sure, and then I started doing it. And then the people who produced it finally wanted me to do the whole thing, and I didn't want to. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to have any kind of friction with Ray. And I said I wouldn't do it. But he was very, very understanding and tolerant about it, and I did the best I could. I stuck religiously to the book. As a matter of fact, there were things, there was a story about later on where they go to this man who is married to these two robots, women, and I had done Usher 2 instead. Also, I had The Shall Come So Frames about the automated house, I had incorporated that into it. It was difficult to try to make one. I mean, it is just a lot of short stories. There's a few characters that recur, but they're all separate stories. So to try to make it one consistent story was the difficulty with it. And to that degree, you had to deviate and still use the stories that Ray had in his book. Some of it, I think, turned out marvelously. As an overall project, I think it was lacking.
You came back to the novel with Vengeance in 1971 and put together three very, very excellent fantasy novels. The first is the horror novel Hell House, and then What Dreams May Come and Bid Time Return. Hell House deals with spiritualism. Had you done any research into that prior to that, or was... did the research into spiritualism come out of the idea of writing a haunted house story?
I'd been a reader of that subject matter for probably 25 years before that. I have quite a library, and it's really, I think, a story of parapsychology rather than spiritualism, although the medium in it is one of the mediums is a spiritualist. No, I knew a lot, and I did a lot of research, and I think it's pretty accurate as far as, you know, my main... the main thing that made this engine run was electromagnetic radiation, and I think to this day, I think that's pretty much the case in psychic phenomena.
Bid Time Return came right after that, and then came What Dreams May Come, which is based upon a great deal of research in the area of life after death. Mm-hmm. Did you have any kind of axe to grind in there, or were you just trying to tell a story?
I mean, after doing research from all those books and having read all the years before that, I had no doubt and don't have any doubt that there is a continuity after what we call death. So I just, as I think I indicated in the introduction, the only thing is made up of this are the characters. Everything else comes from research books. I didn't make up any of it.
There's some allusions to writing for Hollywood in it. Is that autobiographical?
Obviously, since it's in first person, the character is pretty largely going to be me. That would be inevitable.
That book turned into a bit of a cult item and became very hard to locate. Did you have any idea over the years how many people were looking for that book and trying to find it?
One reason I finally talked Jeff Connor into doing it, he was going to do these three suspense novels first, and he has them all in galleys and everything, and I said, I sent him a list of all the people who had written to me about, I've gone to the library, I've asked every bookstore in town, on and on and on, and there are so many people there who want both of those books, so it would make sense to do that, and they sort of tie together, at least I tied them together in my introduction by saying that one is about a love that transcends time, and the other one is about a love that transcends death.
Do you believe that time travel is possible?
Not literally, where you jump into a shiny machine and you go back. I think mentally it must be, because people have predicted the future with great accuracy. They have looked back into the past with great accuracy. Psychics who will hold a stone will describe the dinosaurs that were prevalent at the time that stone was first existed on Earth. I think it's all through the mind, which is what I chose to do in my motion picture, that you make yourself. And when I was down, I wrote it at the Coronado Hotel, a lot of that, and I was all by myself. And I psyched myself into it so much that I could almost swear that I, and that place has an atmosphere of the past, that I just sort of really psyched myself into thinking about any moment now I'm going to pop back.
Why'd you set it in Michigan and not in San Diego?
At one time, a friend and I were talking about making it a television film. We went down to the Coronado Hotel, and we were looking at everything. But everything around the Coronado Hotel is so modern, whereas everything, when they look for a hotel, everything in Michigan fits. They shot the whole thing on this little tiny island, except for a couple of days in Chicago. The entire film was shot there, including every scene.
What do you think of the movie Somewhere in Time?
I like it. I like it. You know, as always, I'm sure it could be improved, but it's certainly a cult movie. A man named Bill Shepard in Covina, of his own volition, started a newsletter devoted just to that one film, and it's gone into its second year. He's got subscribers all through the United States and out of the country, people who just love that film. They came and by the droves to the hotel. They were wearing costumes. I had no idea. It struck a chord. There are certain films that strike a chord, you know, not enough for it to have made a lot of money, although it certainly made a profit, but there is a large following for it and a very devoted following.
Do you feel that then is your most successful or most significant work?
No, I would say What Dreams May Come is the most significant. Well, at the time, Midtime Return was the best written, although this Western that just came out, I think, is awfully well written, too.
When Midtime Return came out, I read it in hardback from the library virtually the moment it came out. I had read a book within the past year before that, Time and Again by Jack Finney. Yes. Did you have any connection with him, or were you shocked when that book came out because you were working on it?
Or? Oh, no, no. I had read Jack's book and all his short stories. I mean, he is the grand maestro of the time travel story. He's my favorite fantasy writer, always has been. I discussed it with him, and he was very supportive, and he loved certain things that I had put in the book, like him finding his own signature in an old dusty copy of the Register. And no accident. The thing about his was it's a wonderful book. I don't think he emphasized the love story as much, which is what I wanted to do. To me, time travel, especially into the past, without a real love story, you know, well, what are you doing it for? His was almost like a documentary. He made it so convincing that you and there again, it was the mind. It was you were convincing yourself.
It seems that the name Richard Matheson has disappeared off novels, at least until recently. Did you just go back into television again?
No, I was working for about 3.5 years on a miniseries for ABC based on Philip Wiley's The Disappearance, which, you know, I thought turned out great. And then just the whole thing was going to, Peter Strauss was going to be in it, and he was going to produce it, his production company. God knows what happened to it. Then I spent another year and a half preparing a 650-page outline for a 20-hour miniseries based on parapsychology, which would deal with the history of parapsychology, what was going on today. That just shook up ABC totally. So then I started writing. I got permission to make a novel out of it, and I wrote about 750 pages of that, which was like part of part one. So the publishing is so costly now. It cost $19.95 for a pamphlet practically today. So that was impractical. So I was always doing something, but nothing came of it. And then I sold this Western, which I had already written. I have just recently sold a second Western. I was working for a long time on a suspense novel, which I had started in 1980, and I finished it up, and that is sold. That will be published, I guess, in the next. So I have three novels.
What are the names of the Westerns and the suspense?
Journal of the Gun Years. Second Western is called The Gunfight, and the suspense novel is called Seven Steps to Midnight.
Are you working on any movies or television around now?
Adapting for television now, L. Ron Hubbard's novel, Fear. Kirstie Alley is going to produce it, and her husband is going to play in it, and the Kelsey Grammer, who's on Cheers, is going to star in it. Oh, and I'm also going to be doing, when I get the chance, it was just closed to me to make a redo on Conjure Wife, which, of course, they call Burn, Wish, Burn. I don't know to what degree it'll be a black picture, but Ernest Dickerson, who is Spike Lee's cameraman, is going to, photographer, director of photography, is going to direct it. I think he directed Juice, this film just came out. And he keeps talking about getting Denzel Washington for the lead. So I haven't discussed it with him to what extent it will be a black picture, totally or partially.
Any chance of What Dreams May Come winding up as a movie?
I sold it to, matter of fact, it was going to be the fellow who produced Somewhere in Time was going to produce it. He was working for Lucille Ball Productions at the time, so I was doing it for them. I had a complete shooting script. We went over to Germany. We met with a guy who directed Das Boot, Wolfgang Petersen. He was going to direct it. The 20th Century already had made him an offer. He accepted. And then Barry Diller took over 20th Century Fox, and when they do that, they always drop whatever projects are going on. And since then, nothing has happened with it. And I don't think the public would be ready for it. I mean, they approach life after death always on this level, always on the earth level, and always in a very stuck in with an entertaining mystery story or a love story or something like that. And this is much more demanding. I don't know whether they'll ever do it. And it would be very costly. Stephen Deutsch, who was going to produce it, felt that it would cost a lot of money because he wanted it to look different. He didn't want it to look like anything you'd ever seen before.
I'm thinking in particular of What Dreams May Come. You say that you did a great deal of research and that you have certain beliefs in that area, but have you had any particular experiences in that area?
No, not really. Not personal experience. I mean, I've gone to psychics any number of times who tell me things, but that doesn't really mean anything to me. They could be just, certainly telepathy is a well-established thing. They could just be picking things up out of my head. I think the funniest one I ever went to was some fellow of dubious persuasion insisted that we all examine him in his underwear first. And then he was in this room, and these figures were all coming in, and there was like a curtain. It was a hallway. Well, these people, it wasn't as if we were in a seat. They were coming down, and the figures would lean over me and say, "Abraham Lincoln," and then move on. And then so, "Mary, Mother of God," and so move on. No peasants, no low-grade people. It was nothing but the best.
In view of your long association with both television and big screen, and your substantial successes and also some of your very serious frustrations that you have described to us, do you have an opinion of the present state of motion pictures and television?
It's the same as publishing today. They're looking for the blockbuster. They don't know what the blockbuster is anymore. They're completely confused because for a while there, the police buddy picture was a big thing. My son and I wrote a script, and we sold it for a lot of money, and it was a wonderful script. And then the director, that's another reason that the films are so bad today. They hire a director. Directors have regained I don't know whether they ever lost it after a certain point, but they have regained a lot of power, and they have the right now, because they're in demand, to just rewrite the entire script, whether it ruins it or not. And mostly it does ruin it because they're not writers. And that's what happened to the script that my son and I wrote. I adapted John Saul's Creature in the last few years. And it turned out very well. They were happy with it. They gave it a go-ahead. They got a director. Boom, he's rewriting the whole thing. I don't know whether he's finished yet. That's been about a year now. So God knows what it's going to end up as.
Do you think that the MTV generation wanting image plays a role in this? I notice when I see a movie these days, plot holes you can jump into on virtually every movie I've seen.
Well, they don't care about that. Movement is, it's interesting, you watch television and you watch a commercial and you turn the sound off and your eyeballs are inundated with this incredible editing. Just before you came here, I was watching a film on television, which I think is really good. It's called The Possession of Joel Delaney, that Waris Hussein directed. And I suddenly realized that judicious editing plus performance is this key to film, not dizzying camera movements, because it was beautifully edited, but he never had the camera flying around people or circling them or going shooting up their nostrils or anything like that. And there's too much of that. I mean, there's so many young directors today. They distract you from what's going on by the way they move the camera, because they want to show you how clever they are. And logic is out the window in a lot of things. Costs, of course, are ridiculous. If a picture doesn't make $100 million, it's a failure. They didn't used to have that.
Do you think there's any ideology behind this, or if a picture that will incite everybody up to be up in arms about, say, government excesses on the environment, that they'd be perfectly willing to shell $50 million out if it'll make $150 million, and that they don't give a damn about the content at all.
Oliver Stone had made money for them. He had made profits for them. He wanted to do this, therefore they let him do it. If his pictures had not made money, he would have not made JFK. No one, you know, maybe there's a certain amount of people involved who wanted to say something, mostly of all Oliver Stone, who seems like a very determined and sincere type of man. But again, if his pictures before that had not made a profit, they wouldn't have let him do it.
There seems to be a certain amount of freedom in Hollywood, but that freedom is completely predicated on making a lot of money.
Yeah, sure. You've got to make money on your pictures. Then they'll let you take a crack at doing what you really want to do. And then very often, you know, look at Bruce Willis. His pictures made tons of money. Then they let him do anything he wanted. And he came up with, Hudson Hawk, which wasn't that bad, but it certainly wasn't good.
But if you had this freedom to make anything you wanted, what would it be?
Oh, gee, I don't know. I mean, there were so many films through the years. I would love to write a swashbuckler. I always loved those films. I don't know why the Western. I'm going into TriStar in a couple of weeks to talk to them about my Western, and a man named Dodi Fayed, who is involved in Chariots of Fire and Greystoke, is very interested in it. And I met with him, and I think he is the sort of man who wants to see. You know, and I my personal feeling is that if it is done correctly, it could be the absolute definitive film of its type.
We're talking on Probabilities on KPFA with author Richard Matheson, whose new book is called
Journal of the Gun Years. That's the one that's out right now.
I'm Richard Walensky with Richard A. Lupoff.